If your restaurant wants to put the best on the table, look for food with a New York State certified seal. It's food that is grown right, right here. Learn more at certified.ny.gov.
This is Michael Harlan Turkel, host of The Food Scene. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, Heritage Radio Network listeners. We're broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, bringing you a brand new episode of The Line. Today, I'm sitting down with Chef Matt Hyland. Matt was born in Brooklyn and then moved to Connecticut, where he attended high school, and then moved on to attend Roger Williams University in Rhode Island. There in his dorm room, if I'm getting the story correct, he shared some pizza with Emily, the woman who would later become his business partner and his wife. Today, they operate Emily in Cobble Hill and Emmy Squared located in Williamsburg. Both locations have garnered many local and national accolades for Matt's unique pizza combinations and flavors. If you're a lover of pizza and love to debate the merits of New York, Neapolitan, New Haven, and even, yes, Detroit-style pizza, this episode will definitely speak to you. Matt, thanks for joining me today on The Line.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to start with what else? Let's start with pizza, right?
Yep.
We can probably both agree that New York is crazy about pizza. Has been for several years. Doesn't seem to be
several years at most.
Doesn't seem to be slowing down. But let's leave Kings County for 1 second and travel a short distance to our neighbor to the north, to Connecticut. I'm pretty in the dark here. I bet a lot of listeners are as well. What's the deal with New Haven pizza?
New Haven pizza is a very underrepresented style of pizza that you can really only get in New Haven. It does have some of the qualities of a New York pizza. It looks like a pizza. Let's start with that.
Okay.
So right there.
It's round. Okay, good.
So, you know, classic New Haven pizza is just usually just sauce with a little bit of a cheese, like a little pecorino or Parmesan sprinkled on it. And there's also the famous New Haven clam pies. And when they cook their pizza, they usually cook them very well done. And that's something I really like about New Haven pizza is like it's almost burned.
So when you say burned, are you talking about the bottom of the crust or the actual toppings are also kind of charred or?
It's more of like the outside rim of it. So the top crust part of it, it's usually has a black, it looks like a black ring around instead of like just a kind of blonde or beige looking.
And there's all this kind of New Haven lingo, right? Like there's besides the char, I mean, there's like, for example, I did a little research that you order Moots mozzarella and it's you don't call it mozzarella, and it's like a topping that it doesn't come standard on the pizza, right? Are there any other weird kind of big differentials between what we would consider like a New York slice joint pizza and a New Haven pizza?
Well, they definitely don't sell slices. It's usually
whole
pies.
No slices?
Yeah, no
okay,
slices.
Cool.
Most of the places are, there's a few famous places, it's just whole pies. You don't order a slice. Ordering a regular pizza does not automatically come with mozzarella as a New York one would. So it's basically a tomato pizza with a little bit of the sprinkled cheese on it. And then you can order the cheese.
So you moved to Connecticut from Brooklyn at a young age?
Like 9 years old.
Okay. And so where exactly did you move to? Close to New Haven? Were you close to the pizza mecca of Connecticut?
Not really. We moved to Greenwich, which is about 45 minutes from New York and around 45 minutes from New Haven. So it's kind of in between.
So who did you move there with? Both your parents? Yep. Do you have any siblings?
I have an older brother.
Okay. And so why the move from Brooklyn to Connecticut?
I think it was time for my brother to go to middle school or high school. I don't remember which one at that time. And it was just, it would have been like a 3-bus transfer to go to the school he was going to go to from Bay Ridge. So I think they just moved to Connecticut. My dad is also from Connecticut, from Greenwich. So it just made sense. Like they go back to where they're from.
So what do you feel like you're a Brooklyn guy or do you feel like you're a Connecticut guy?
I'm definitely a Connecticut guy.
Okay.
I mean, I remember Brooklyn very well as a child, but you know, my formative years, you know, from 9, 10 years old onward were spent at Connecticut.
So what's that like to be, what does that mean? Your formative years in Connecticut? What does that consist of? I'm imagining a really green, big yard and a lot of, you know, football on Sunday
exactly.
What else?
I love sledding. That was something that I never did in Brooklyn.
I love sledding too. I'm a Michigan guy. Who doesn't love sledding?
So sledding was great. What else was good in Connecticut? I don't know. It's just very green and lots of places to play and, you know, it's beautiful.
So when you you move from the from Brooklyn out there to the suburbs, basically, are you a food family? Are you interested in food at that point? Does it play a role in your life?
We weren't necessarily like one of those families that was, you know, it's like food is king. I mean, I always loved eating. And my, you know, we'd always have Sunday meals together with a grandma. And even in Connecticut, she moved actually up to Connecticut also from Brooklyn to be close to us. So, you know, we'd have our Sunday dinners together and we'd eat dinner together every night. But it wasn't some sort of like insane food culture that some people grew up in. It was just their normal house.
And so when you say a Sunday dinner with grandma, is that what's the general foods that's being served at that? Is it an Italian dinner?
Italian.
Okay.
Yeah. So,
and so is that a grandma sauce type of deal?
Yep. So okay. Grandma would make sauce. You know, it'd be usually some sort of a baked pasta of some sort, like ziti with like, you know, red sauce and baked. She'd make meatballs once in a while, and there'd be two types of meatballs. One would be with raisins and one would be without raisins.
Cool.
And that would be, you know, I always want the ones without raisins. And my uncle would always want no raisins. Everyone else loved the raisin ones, but I wasn't into it.
I guess when you're a little kid, like meatballs with raisins is probably a pretty weird food item that you're trying to probably avoid. I love this idea of, you know, family sitting down to dinner. It spans all cultures, you know, like I'm Jewish. We do bagels at brunch. It seems to be like the Northeast, a lot of Italian families, there's the Sunday meal. Was that based out of, like, were you required to be at that meal, or was it more just like, oh, if you're around, grandma's going to make meatballs?
Oh, no, it was a requirement. Because we either go to her house or my mom would be making it. So it would be, again, it's time for dinner. We all sit down. And then actually every night for dinner, we'd actually sit down, and my parents would try to time it with putting Jeopardy on, like at 7 o'clock. It would be like, we sit down, we eat, Jeopardy goes on, and then like then the TV. That's the only time we'd ever be allowed to watch TV is if Jeopardy was on, and then the TV would go off. That's it.
Nice. Yeah. Okay, so let's transition a little bit forward. I want to know. So you went to school in Rhode Island, and you got an information science degree.
Yep.
Right. So your family's not a crazy food family. You go to school for information sciences. First off, what is that? And then also, I want to know how does someone who really isn't that into food really in their early life goes to college for a very specific degree? How do you end up in Chef White's?
That's a good question. I actually asked myself that too.
You're like, I'm still asking
myself
how this happened.
I was of the four people in my family, I was the only one without an econ degree. So even getting a computer science degree was sort of, they were like, what is, you know, why not econ? And I was like, I don't know. Like, I just, I'm not interested in economics. I'm not interested in like, like whatever the three of you are doing. So that was sort of all right, like, you know, I really like computers as well. So I enjoyed taking them apart and putting them back together. So it just seemed like a natural thing. And then maybe by, I don't know, junior year, I was very disillusioned with just fixing, you know, computers and doing like internships at like companies that were making computers, things like that. So it was just, I really love to cook and I really love food. And I felt like being on my own in college, like I just had time to sort of like eat whatever I want to and not be, you know, here's the meal for tonight from mom and dad. It's just like, you just start experimenting and like trying to cook things in like, in our apartment. And, you know, it just sort of went from there.
Did you do a lot of exploring, trying restaurants that you probably wouldn't have tried otherwise, or was it mostly in home kind of recipe testing to a certain degree?
Yeah, I tried a lot of restaurants I wouldn't normally have, you know, growing up also, we went to a lot of varied, ethnic restaurants too. We'd always go to, you know, the city and, you know, eat Indian food and Thai food and things like that when I was younger. So, I had a good exposure to food, but it wasn't necessarily like a way of life.
Do you see any, is there a crossover? Is there a lot of applicability from breaking down and building computers to putting food together, or am I grasping at straws here?
No. One thing that I think really helped with, program writing and things like that was, trying to not necessarily making the dish, but trying to systematize how to make a dish. So when I'm in my kitchen and I'm looking at something that's not working efficiently, if there's a pickup that's not necessarily right, it's just, how can I make this, like a really inconsistent like job, like cooking, how can I make this more efficient like a computer? So it's like, how do you minimize the motions? How do you minimize movements? you know, is this pan right? Like just sort of trying to systematize every, looking at every single thing and being like, this could be more efficient. This could be more efficient. This isn't working right. The heat here, heat, you know, the things like that sort of help when you have a computer science degree.
And so I want to build on that and talk about actually when you joined the Breslin as part of the opening team, you were actually more focused on the administrative side.
Yep.
You just alluded to systems and putting those in place. It seems like perhaps you were very much so the right man for the job. But how did that feel to be part of an opening team but not being on the line? What's it like being on the computer side?
Yeah, it was the first job I ever had in the cooking world that was not actually cooking, except for like varied events offsite. But you know, just watching them trying to put things together and then hiring and you know, doing all the administrative work was it was sort of like a collision of two worlds of like my past and the computers and like my, what I'm doing in like cooking. So it was a very interesting job.
And it seems like you were the perfect person for it, right? Like you had that computer background. You were obviously very focused on systems, but you knew the kitchen. Did you feel was the kitchen pulling you back, or did you feel like you were in the right spot at that time?
Yeah, I think I was at the right spot, and I feel like after a while of working there, I was like, oh, like maybe I do want to go into the administrative side of the restaurant world. But then you know, it sucked me back in again. I was like, I can't just watch all this action happen. Just kind of stand by.
What sucked you back in?
There's just little things where you could watch when you're watching someone like saute, and like those like the grease from the pan just kind of shoots out and makes those sparks out the edge. It's like things like that where it's like looking, like seeing something like that. It's just like it's such like a primal, like primitive thing that's happening, and it's like beautiful in its own way. And like you know, staring at a computer screen is it's fine, but you know, it's not necessarily like what I want to be doing. And it's why I left computers in the first place.
You alluded earlier to the point of, you know, you're looking at all the systems that go on in a kitchen. What's the right pan? I want to talk a little bit about in your own restaurants. How has your computer background and your love of organization, how has it affected your leadership style? How do you organize your kitchen?
Like staff-wise, or like how I'm just kind of running it, or
both.
Anything?
Yeah, I want to hear about like how does your brain work in the kitchen, because you come from an actual trained, you know, computer science background. You know, you love these processes.
Yeah, one thing I do love about the process of like wood-fired cooking is how inconsistent and like you know really hard it is. So trying to process trying to do something so inconsistent, like we're cooking a wood-fired oven, trying to make it more consistent, it's just something I love to figure out. Like, what size wood is it going to go in, and what type of wood, and where to place it in the oven, and where to put the andiron, and like when to raise it, and like control the fan. So it's sort of, you know, again, and then every piece of wood is different. So when you put it in, like different things happen. So it's just really just trying to figure it out and then relay that information as efficiently as possible. Like, we use a communication tool called Slack. I don't know if you know that, where,
the instant messaging kind
basically,
of thing?
Basically, where like people don't have to necessarily... It's like a group instant messaging that people don't have to be looking at all the time. So we love using Slack in the kitchen too, because we just like, you know, bang out information to all the people in there. You know, they get like dish ideas, they get specials, like things like that, just sort of...
Well, this is fascinating to me, because the people that I know that use Slack work in tech companies. Mm-hmm. The kitchen is usually a place of... chaos to a certain extent.
That's a good way to put it.
There's maybe a recipe book. If the kitchen is very organized, there's a recipe book and there's scales being used.
Yep.
But a lot of times it's either the chef teaches you how to make it and you have your little notebook in your back pocket, which I hope you never lose, right? But even sometimes there's just scraps of paper around or the chef makes it and no one else knows how to make it. But you're talking about really modern communication in your kitchen. How hard was it to get people to adopt the modernity of your kitchen?
Front of house was very easy. They're on their phones all the time anyway. I'm telling them to get off the phone.
Right.
So they're checking Slack.
They're like, I'm on Slack, man.
Yeah,
it's
exactly,
fine.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure. So that was really easy. Back of house, we're getting there. You know, I mean, not everyone has a smartphone. So right there, like that's sort of a challenge. But all of the leaders in the kitchen and the restaurants, they're on it, and like they'll do shift notes on there so people can see it. There's like locked channels where like only the management can see it, so it works out really well.
That's a great way of kind of organizing all the information that gets drilled down in the kitchen, do you also keep kind of like a master document of all your little tweaks and everything? Like when you get the wood right and you get the timing right on a dish, is that all happening through Slack, or is that all, is that you kind of off to the side trial and error doing it, and then you're letting everyone else know this is the way?
So I will usually do it and then relay that information.
And how long is that taking you to kind of like, how long did it take you to drill down to where you were happy with your first Emily pizza?
I'm still not happy with it. Every single pizza is like is another challenge. I mean, again, with the wood oven, it's always a struggle to just be happy with everyone. Cause like even pizza to pizza, it could just be slightly different, and like no one would ever notice, but I'm going to notice, and I'm just going to try to make it better every time.
So no pizza is 100% there yet?
Well, they're all there. I'd say not, for me, they're not. But for everyone who works and everyone who eats and loves it, it is. But I'm always going to be my biggest critic.
Okay. Yeah. And so is there a constant tweaking of the pizzas on the menu, or are some at a point where they stay very consistent? Are you still kind of playing around with some of the pizzas at Emily and Emmy Squared?
We have like a greatest hit section on both of them. Emmy Squared is much newer, so the menu hasn't changed that much. You know, at Emily, we have seasonal stuff that comes on and off. So yeah, it just really depends. You know, if we feel like making some pizza, we'll, you know, buy some stuff and make it, or same with like the plates. You know, it just really depends on, we just kind of cook what we want to eat, what it really comes down to.
So for me personally, as a cook, this is like something kind of embarrassing that I'm going to share with you and all the listeners, that I really don't eat pizza. I stopped eating cheese almost like 8 years ago. Mm-hmm. It was, not making my life pleasant. So like when I'm at the restaurant, when I've gone to a pizza place with my friends, you know, I'm the odd person out, you know, I'll eat the other item on the menu, or on occasions I'm that person who calls the delivery pizza joint and gets a half cheeseless pizza and I'll split it with my roommate. So, I'm not allergic. I just say that I avoid cheese. So I kind of go to a restaurant and maybe the server rolls their eyes at me and then they go back into the kitchen, right? So now we're at you. You're in the kitchen. You get – the server comes back and they say, got somebody out there. They don't eat cheese. Will you do a cheeseless pizza? Is that something that you'll do at your restaurants, or is that – no. Is that against what you believe in?
Oh, no. We have a pizza on the menu that does not have cheese.
Okay.
And then if someone doesn't want to have cheese on, it's fine. People modify pizzas all the time. The only thing we don't do is if it's someone wants a half, like a half and a half, where it's like half of one pizza and half of another one.
Okay.
Because the pizzas are so small, it gets complicated, where it's like, you know, they want half a tomatillo pizza and half a red pizza. We can't really divide the sauces on a tiny pie. But other than that, any sort of modification to pizzas we're fine with. It's just, you know, whatever you want. Pizza's fun, so.
Well, I like that you said that pizza is fun. So I want to take this a little bit deeper. About customer experience, like in the broader sense of the restaurant. So supposedly, you know, the restaurants are in the hospitality business. Mm-hmm. You could argue against that. Many people that have been to many a Brooklyn and New York restaurant might disagree with my statement there. But often what you get at restaurants is this curated chef experience. Mm-hmm. You just said pizza is supposed to be fun. You said that you'll modify pizzas. Do you think in the broader sense, like, is the era of the diner is always right dead? Like, for you specifically, and also, what do you think about kind of the grander New York dining landscape about that?
Well, I mean, at Emily, we have actually two sides of that argument at Emily, where we don't allow people to mess with the burger, because that's something that it's very labor intensive, and our restaurant's very, very small, where it's just sort of like, it just has to kind of come out as it is. Like, we really can't modify. But everything else on the menu, you can kind of do whatever you want to. Yeah, I mean, I like going to restaurants where it is like a no modification thing for a nicer place, because this is what the chef wants you to have, so you should eat it and the way it is. But, you know, for like if I was like a diner or something and they were like, no, you can't have it, it's like really? You know, or like a pizza place where it's, I've actually been to a pizza place that, you know, I wanted a, they had one of the fried pizzas, the Montanaro fried pizzas, and like I want to add pepperoni to it, and they're like, absolutely not. I'm like, It's like, what's the difference? Like, just throw pepperoni. Like, why? Uh-huh. Like, you know, you like they had ones with other toppings, but like putting it, or it was ones, it was like spiced salami on it. And I was like, well, I'm like, okay.
So, like, so for you, you feel like there are certain restaurants that you're okay with it being more strict and others that you kind of find it ridiculous that they are. So what's kind of a dining experience for you where that you feel like, oh, it's, I'm coming here to specifically get that? Is there a certain type of cuisine that you feel is not to be changed?
I mean, fine dining.
Okay.
Today's Emily's anniversary.
Oh, congratulations.
And we're going to Danielle tonight.
Awesome.
So I would never go in there and be like, no, I want some different sauce on this. You know, that'd be just like,
But what's interesting about Danielle is you could probably make any demand.
Yeah,
you could make the most outlandish demand. You could say, hey, I'm Matt Hyland. I'd like a burrito right now. It's my anniversary. And they're going to be scrambling and back. They're like, Matt Hyland wants a burrito. Come on, make it happen. So how do you feel about fine dining? Like, is it a – I mean, you're obviously going there tonight for a special occasion. But do you like the space that you're in with your restaurants? Do you ever contemplate going the fine dining route?
Fine dining, it just, I love eating at fine dining establishments. It just seems like just not the style of food that, you know, I would get into. I sort of like the primal sort of pizza, you know, in the wood oven and with the Detroit pizza we're doing, it's kind of like almost like a kid oriented pizza and it's fun. And like, I really like the, I like to be able to cook what I want to eat. And like, I don't always want to eat fine dining. So I wouldn't necessarily be happy cooking fine dining food. And I'm not necessarily sure that, you know, I would want to be like, just like focusing on like little, like microgreens every single day. That's not necessarily what I like to cook. I love eating it though, but I don't want to really cook it every day.
We're here with Matt Hyland from Emily and Emmy Squared. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Music in this break is by Tackstar. This one's called Relax, It's Just the End of the World. We'll be right back.
New York chefs and restaurants are proud of the food they put on the table. And serving produce that comes from local, environmentally responsible farms is a way to leave an even better taste in everyone's mouth. So when shopping for your ingredients, look for the New York State Grown and Certified seal. It lets you know which food is grown right here in New York State, certifying the food that comes from local farms that meet a higher standard. You'll not only be serving local food, you'll be supporting local farmers. Learn more about the New York State Grown and Certified program at certified.ny.gov.
Welcome back to The Line. We're here with Matt Hyland, chef and co-owner of Emily and Emmy Squared. We've been talking about how he liked to put a lot of systems in place in his kitchen and how they utilize technology to keep the kitchens connected using a modern tool called Slack. We're also talking a lot about pizza. I want to talk about you and your wife as partners. So my brother is my business partner, and we've worked closely for many years. We shared an apartment. So I feel like to a small extent, I understand what your working relationship might be like. And I'm sure there's listeners out there that say, oh, I work with my spouse. I run a business with my roommate. It's great to be able to work with someone who you trust completely. And you know, I value my brother's feedback more than anyone else. I would like to ask you about working with your spouse, what is it like to be a partner with your wife, Emily?
It's very rewarding. We get to see each other a lot, but it's also difficult in the sense that it's hard to separate work time from not work time, where it's, you know, we're basically almost always working on both the restaurants from the time like we wake up, you know, we're checking emails to like, you know, you know, communicating with managers and then going to check on the restaurants. And then if we have to work that night, we'll do that and then come home and talk about the day and the night. And then all of a sudden it's like, you know, a week's gone by and we've just done restaurant stuff. There's been like no dinner together or no, you know, like no going for a walk or anything. And so it just, it's difficult to separate that time, like the personal time, you know. And obviously when you're with somebody, who's your partner, I mean, there'll be like, you know, differences in opinions on the restaurants and things like that. But it's really nice to, we always have the same goal and it's like make the restaurant succeed. So that's never been questioned, where it's nice to have that sort of bond with somebody where like it's undying, completely undying, like dedication to the goal of the restaurants.
It's a unique situation, the setup you have, because your successes and your failures are so intertwined. Like it's all the same day. Mm-hmm. Have you found a way in your life to just, is there a non-restaurant hour of the week that you're not allowed to talk about the restaurant? Something like that. I guess I'm asking mostly about like both of your sanity as restaurant owners, which is so hard. And then the fact that your apartment, it doesn't turn off. Like how does that make you feel?
Sometimes it's nice to stay busy, you know, but yeah, it's tough when it's like, all right, let's go out to dinner. And then like sometimes it's dinner and all of a sudden, like, you know, the phone starts blowing up. There's a problem with the restaurant or things like that just sort of arise. So we kind of just take it like one day at a time of, you know, if today the restaurant didn't burn down or the sink exploded or whatever. Like today's a good day. And, you know, we'll just call it that. But we do as much as we can. Like, you know, we'll put like a date on the calendar. It's like, all right, we're having dinner here tonight. Like, put in the calendar, it's like, this is our plan, so we'll have some time together that's not work related.
So who gets that first call? A sink explodes, you know,
it's me.
It's you.
It's
okay.
Me. So I get that call, and then I'll tell Emily, because I'm you know, I think that I have no idea how to do any sort of electrical or plumbing or anything, but like I'll just take things apart and see what happens, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. So like I'll have that sort of first reaction of, all right, let's just take this apart, let's unplug things, let's just, you know, throw water on it or hit it with a wrench. I don't know.
And have you had any true success taking apart something at the restaurant and saying, oh, I shouldn't call a plumber, I shouldn't call an electrician? You know, have you actually been able to fix problems that way?
Yeah, I actually fixed a lowboy, which was completely like by luck. You know, I just like took apart like a piece of the motor and then like I have no idea what I'm looking at. I was like, all right, here's a something. I unscrewed it and like it looked like there was like a little jam on the propeller, the fan there. Was like, it's not even a propeller, it's a fan, so I didn't even know what to call it. And then like I cleaned it and like put it back together and like I was like, okay, and, like now it worked. It's like
it's awesome that you saved several hundred bucks.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
You didn't also electrocute yourself in the process. That's one of the craziest things about being a restaurant owner, right? Like can you speak about what it feels like to first have one restaurant? You're the guy, right? You get the call. You have to be there for service. How does it feel to own a restaurant? And then I'll ask you the same question about owning two restaurants.
Owning just Emily was it was a lot, but it was a small restaurant. It's only 40 seats. So, you know, just being there every day, I could even not be there for a few days and it's like everything would be fine and just check in and constantly checking in. And then, you know, something like I said, like something like didn't work, I could address the situation, maybe not in an emergency, you know, call in the middle of the night or something, but I could be there and try to fix something. If not, call the plumber. And like, it's after what, you know, 2 years, it was pretty, it wasn't easy, but it was getting easier and like getting a little more routine and systematic in the sense of we kind of know what's going to happen next in a way.
Mm-hmm. So then you threw another restaurant in.
Yeah, that we were supposed to open next door, just a slice takeout shop, and then the lease fell through, and then a friend of a friend showed us the new location that we're in now.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just it's a very large restaurant, and we were...
How big is it?
It's about 60 seats upstairs, and then we have 40 seats in the basement bar, which we serve burgers in the bar in the basement.
Right.
So, yeah, it's large, and it's much bigger than the concept we had. And it was supposed to be a manageable takeout store right next to the old location. And like, all right, let's just go for it. You know, let's just go for it. Like, who, like, you gotta take a risk sometimes, and we did.
Do you ever feel like you bit off more than you can chew with the second location?
I think in the first, like, few, like 2 months, maybe. We've only been open, I guess, what, 6 months? But in the first month or so, when I was, like, on the line every day there, and, like, lunch and dinner, it was like, what have I done? You know, like, it was really tough, but... You know, we hired we have really great staff, and we hired up like really, really well. And the dedication is there too. Like, people believe in the restaurant the same way they believe in Emily. So it works out. It's working out very well.
How do you manage two restaurants? And if you can, and if you would, speak a little bit for your wife as well, and just how you kind of cooperate the projects. But it seems so difficult to manage two projects that are even right next to each other. And you actually have two places that are several miles apart. You spoke a little bit earlier about Slack and communication. Do you use that between the two restaurants as well? Do you use a Thomas Keller TV screen so you can see what's going on in the kitchen of Emily? You can speak a little to managing two restaurants and what goals you have accomplished and what other things maybe have slipped through the cracks.
Managing two at once, again, this Slack is the most important thing. I mean, I was at 7 o'clock in the morning, I was slacking out just some things that need to be done at ME Squared. You know, and the team there, they're very responsive. I don't expect them to be up that early, but if they are and they return the Slacks that early, it's like, great. You know, things need to get painted or a door needs to get fixed. There's things like that right away, you know, they're on it. So that's really nice to have that. And then, you know, I'll go back and forth between the restaurants. I've been at Emmy Squared a lot lately, so I've been focusing more attention there. Emily's been at Emily lately to focus attention there. So it's nice to be able to split ourselves up where we have the same, you know, goals and same ideas where one will be at one and one will be at the other. So that kind of makes it a little bit easier.
And does she handle staffing, back of house, the books? What exactly is her role in the businesses?
Yeah, she mostly does the administrative side. We're stepping away a little bit from that. We're trying to get more managers to do that kind of stuff. But originally it was, I would do all back of house, she'd do all front of house. And that's how it worked.
How does that feel actually to take a little step away? Is it freeing or terrifying?
It's both. I mean, like, sometimes I'll be like, oh, like, I have an hour to, like, do nothing or walk around. And it's like, it feels uncomfortable sometimes. Maybe I should be doing something.
Why does it feel uncomfortable, though? I mean, you have the business and you're simultaneously trying to grow it. You also want to create some personal space. But do you feel like you're moving towards the right goal by stepping away a little bit?
Definitely. You can only micromanage so much. And then you also want to drive the employees crazy. Because if I walk in there, it's like, oh, why is this like this? Why is this like this? Why? And then it's like, oh, great. You know, it's like people don't like that. So, you know, I have my managers on my chef de cuisine do that kind of stuff too, where, you know, he's doing it and I'm not just the one walking, just complaining and then leaving. Mm-hmm. So it's nice to sort of have another layer of a person, you know, have their eyes on it and not necessarily like just, you know, I don't have to worry when I know that these managers are there because they're the ones looking out for it. So I can step back and not just be panicked all the time, but everything is wrong always.
At this point you have, ME is Squared has been open for about 6 or 7 months. Which restaurant do you like being in more right now?
I guess just because the amount of space we have at ME Squared, I can sit in the burger bar during the daytime, and it's like almost like a little office, like it's a big room, and it's nice to be able to like spread out a little bit. So that, but I love walking into Emily and smelling the wood oven, you know. So I kind of love both of them equally. I do enjoy eating at ME Squared more right now because I've eaten Emily food, you know, a lot. So 6 months is still novel to me for the type of food I can eat there.
So, your menu at both spots, I would say, is made up of crowd pleasers. And I'm going to summarize here, not to imply that the food is simple, but just so that our listeners can get sort of like a general overview. You have olives, pickles, usually a very few market salads, wings at ME Squared. You have the famous burger. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you have pizza. So at first glance, it seems like all foods that people are very familiar with. Do you think this puts pressure on you to deliver sort of more incredible or elevated versions of well-known items, or does it remove the pressure that everyone is familiar with this food?
I think it actually adds a little pressure because everyone has their ideal about what something should be. It's like, this is not a real burger. This is not real pizza. It's like, well, like, what is then, you know? Like, it's, you know, I think people try to chase down their childhood nostalgia on food and, like, place their thoughts on what something should be, but it might not necessarily be good, or it might not work for the way a restaurant has to pick something up. So, yeah, I think it is, you know, it is a little bit of pressure to please people with food like pizza and burgers, which people are very opinionated about to begin with.
And so that nostalgia for you, though, you don't actually do a Brooklyn or a New Haven pizza, right?
Correct.
So was that purposeful to avoid a copying of a nostalgic memory, or how did the pizza flavors come about?
We didn't really want to label it as this style of pizza. Like, mm-hmm. It's a style of pizza Emily and I like to eat and that we came up with. So, you know, it's kind of burned and crunchy, and we use all American products. So, you know, the burned char comes from a little bit of the New Haven style. We try to make the flavors taste a little bit like a New York pizza, you know, and obviously cooked Neapolitan style in a Neapolitan oven, but it's not Neapolitan style either. So it's just sort of, here's just a lot of great pizza cultures, and here's just my influences of what I like, and here's our pizza, you know, so that's really what we have to offer.
You sell a $26 hamburger at Emmy Squared.
That's at Emily.
Oh, at Emily.
Emmy Squared, it's actually 22, so it's a bargain.
It's a real steal.
Yeah.
Did that ever give you pause to put an item on the menu at that price point in a neighborhood joint?
It did. It actually started as an $18 burger, mm-hmm. But then as we started kind of ramping up the quality of the stuff we were using, we got a better meat purveyor. We changed to dry aged. We changed to nicer cheese. And then we finally changed to the pretzel bun. And all those things put together, you know, it adds up. So at 18, you know.
When you say it adds up, because of labor and sourcing?
Yeah, labor, sourcing, just the amount of time it takes to create this product in a pizza place, which is made for pizza volume. You know, we can easily kick out 300 pizzas a night in a small restaurant and doing delivery, but, you know, we had to buy a new refrigerator for the meat. We had to buy, you know, the things like that. We had to buy a new range to cook the burgers on hot enough. So, you know, it's really, like that burger, like, it's really a lot of work, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think the price is justified.
And so why a burger at a pizza joint?
Yeah. Going back to just, we like to cook what we like to eat was, mm-hmm. I was just sick of eating pizza one night and I was like, I'm going to put a burger on the menu special. And we sold like one a night, usually zero a night, you know, we'd have leftover meat and we'd use it for family meal. You know, we'd have buns frozen because like we couldn't hit the minimums for getting like one bun a day. It didn't make sense. And then all of a sudden, all at once, like three or four articles came out just being like, this is the best burger. And then it was like, okay, well, now we can't have enough burgers in-house. So we put the cap on about 25 a night.
I'm glad that you actually mentioned that. So the articles came in and they said, got to go to this pizza joint and get a hamburger, right?
Yeah.
Do you worry about critics? And do you worry about critics now? And did you worry about them before they gave you such strong reviews for both the pizza and the burger?
Well, we didn't even know we were like a restaurant that could get any critic in, really. You know, we were just making pizza like on Fulton Street and it was just sort of like, okay, like this is what we do. And here's our burger. And we're having fun doing it. And yeah. And all this good press started coming in and just, you know, we're really, you know, it was really lucky. It was mostly positive. So that's really, you know, it was, I wasn't like surprised in the sense of, you know, we really put our heart into it. So everything like was mostly positive, but I was kind of surprised that people would actually take the time to come to, you know, our tiny little place and review it. So that was nice.
So who do you cook for now?
Depends on where I'm needed. I cooked at home. I say for the first time about 2 years, I cooked at home like recently.
What'd you make?
I made a bolognese, like mm-hmm. a chicken bolognese. Emily doesn't eat beef or anything like that. So a chicken bolognese with some pasta. And it was nice and simple and tasty.
What's the home fridge look like since you're both at the restaurants? Do you even eat at home ever? Is it just out or at your own restaurants?
Basically. Tons of condiments. Like just dozens and dozens of condiments. People drop by samples. You know, like vendors drop by samples. And it's a fridge of condiments. So if I were to make a sandwich at home, it would be pretty baller on condiments.
I want to focus on the building of a dish and ask kind of like the part of your brain that dominates. Are you a businessman or a chef first when you're building your pizzas at the restaurant?
Definitely a chef first, and then I'll price it accordingly. Mm-hmm. And if it's something ridiculous, then it just won't go on.
Okay.
You know, I like building flavor profiles of, you know, things that are nicely like salty and sweet and fatty and rich and delicious. And pizza's a very good vehicle for that kind of stuff, putting on a dough.
In terms of, you know, you've mentioned sourcing a lot. I know that you source almost exclusively from the United States.
Pretty much. Only our pecorino is imported.
Can you talk about how you made that decision, and also specifically how can a chef be responsible as part of the community and the neighborhood? Why did you choose to source the way that you do?
You know, I really love like very classic Neapolitan pizza with everything imported from Italy. But then when you start having all these places that are importing everything from the same distributor coming out of Italy, everything starts to taste the same. So right there, like that's, if I'm going to open a place and it's going to taste the same as all the other places, it doesn't really make sense, you know? And then with places like Franny's and like Roberta's, who are just, you know, kind of started that, well, we have just as good stuff in America, if not better, and it's fresher. It's not coming, you know, over, it doesn't take a week to get here, and it's beautiful. Like, you know, and then again, the variety then too, like we don't have to have one single importer from Italy getting us the same stuff. We can just make relationships with people we like and farmers and things like that. I think it's a lot more special.
How did you build those relationships?
I like to take tours of facilities. Mm-hmm. We used to have pasta on our menu, and we went to go visit this Foglini factory, which I really like their pasta.
Where is that?
It's in the Pfizer building.
Okay.
Foglini. Very, really, really good stuff. And then Myers Produce, which is a produce company from Annie Myers. She drives around to farms all over the Massachusetts, Vermont, and picks up stuff and then brings it straight to restaurants. So it's things like that are really nice and very seasonal, and you get really good stuff. It's not like using like a Baldor account where things just sort of
show up at your door,
yeah. And like everyone gets the same thing.
Who deserves credit for who you are today as a chef?
It's got to be Emily. I mean, that's really what it is. Most of my family, like when I want to start cooking, they were encouraging, but they're kind of like, eh, you know, like whatever. But Emily's like, no, you should do it. Like Emily's always pushing me to like do what I want to do. And like, you know, even with like a dish, she's encouraged me, like, no, it should be like this. It should be like this. And like, it kind of encourages me and like makes me think and like ask the tough questions of like, you know, what about this dish is good or bad and things like that. So she's definitely the one that I'd probably be a computer science guy if I haven't met Emily.
You have two restaurants right now. Are you the chef that you hope that you would be? Are you there yet, or are you? How do you feel about the current state of your career and having two restaurants?
I'm surprised I am where I am, in the sense of, you know, New York is very competitive and like it's really hard to stand out. So I'm happy that. We are, but again, I think with cooking, there's so much learning you can do and so much getting better. You know, I mean, I'm not like a master of anything really. So, you know, to get to a point where like, you know, you can look back and be something in a tough city and not just like a flash in the pan, like, you know, there's still a lot of time to go. So eventually one day I'll look back and be like, okay, New York's tough. Like I survived it, you know? So one day, you know what? I'm not there yet. I'm always going to strive to make things better. So,
Matt, thanks so much for being with us. Join us next week, Tuesdays, 11 a.m., The Line on Heritage Radio.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.